Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Warren Buffett has a nice line. When he thinks about giving his money away to his children versus to other causes, he wants to give his kids enough that they can do something, but not so much that they can do nothing.
If you can't take it with you, what should you do with it?
You've got some money as an individual. The state has three choices before it about how it should treat you and your money. It can respect your liberty to do with it what you want. It can limit your liberty to do with it what you want. Or it can subsidize you to act on your liberty to give money away, give you a tax break.
Should the government care how much we give and to whom we give?
People give money away because people ask them to, because it's important for them to, because it's a virtue to do so.
Our guest is Rob Reich from Stanford University.
You want to give it away to a puppet theater, baldness research, Oxfam International, whatever, that's your business.
The morality of giving and keeping.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Philosophy Talk is on the road again. We're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Classic Residence by Hyatt in Palo Alto, California.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today's program is made possible in part with support from the Stanford Humanities Center.
We're very pleased to meet some of our listeners here at the Hyatt Residence up close and personal. Folks, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today, the morality of giving and keeping.
Giving and keeping what, Ken?
Well, one's wealth, John. Americans are among the richest people in the world, and I think that with our good fortune comes a special obligation to give and to give generously to others.
Well, I'm sure that's true for Bill Gates and probably for you, too. But for a guy like me, I'm well off, but I got kids, I got grandkids. Don't I mainly have an obligation to provide for them?
Well, maybe you do have some obligations to those near and dear, but you can't just thumb your nose at the rest of the world either. It's about striking a balance between competing goods. You owe something to those near and dear, but you also owe it to others to help where you can.
Well, you're very good at figuring out what I owe. Actually, people give for a lot of reasons. They don't just give because they think they have a duty or they owe something. They care about causes and institutions. They don't just give out of a sense of duty. They want to make a statement, leave a legacy, promote causes that they really think are important.
Well, you're right. People don't just give in ways that help the needy. Sometimes they give to already wealthy institutions that help already well-heeled people. But when they could be, you know, giving to alleviate human suffering. But here's the question. Is that really morally okay? Is that permissible?
Yes. I mean, why shouldn't it be? Why shouldn't people be free to give whatever they want to whomever they want for whatever reason they want as long as it doesn't scare the horses?
Well, think about it at least from a public policy point of view. At the moment, the government is kind of doesn't discriminate between different ways of giving. It'll give you a tax benefit for giving to a wealthy institution like Stanford, or to give you the same tax benefit for giving the same amount of money to an organization like Habitat for Humanity. But shouldn't the government discriminate between different kinds of institutions and different kinds of giving?
Well, why should it? Why should the government care, stick its nose into the question of to whom I give my money?
Well, because one thing about a government in a democratic society is one of its jobs is to try and ameliorate social inequalities. That's why, to help ameliorate social inequalities.
Well, since that's the government's job, to help ameliorate social inequalities, it's really important that private individuals do things that are good for society but don't count as doing that, like giving to Stanford.
Well, I mean, you got a point there. If people give to Stanford, that's fine, but maybe the government should, you know, encourage them to give to these other causes that help promote social equality and maybe discourage them from giving to institutions that don't do that.
Well, just kind of think out the consequences of that line of thinking. So the people in Palo Alto don't get a tax break for giving to the Palo Alto schools for athletic teams and bands, but they would if they gave to the Oakland, which admittedly needs it more. But the end result of that is they're not going to give to anybody, and we're not going to have bands on either side of the bay.
Well, you know, there are a lot of issues here. I mean, you raise an important point and one we should talk about. And joining us in a little bit will be Rob Reich, an expert on the morality of giving and keeping. I think he'll help us sort all this out.
We'll start by asking Rob to discuss the idea of striking a moral balance between our obligations to those near and dear and our obligations to the broader human community.
Then we'll take up issues about public policy. Should the government favor some kinds of giving over others, or should all such decisions be left to the free choice of individual citizens?
Then we'll conclude on a practical note by asking how we can give more effectively.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, has spent some time with someone who has given quite a lot. She files this report.
Bert McMurtry and his wife Dee Dee have donated tens of millions of dollars to philanthropic causes, including big gifts to Stanford and Rice universities. But McMurtry says they both grew up solidly in the middle class and never expected to have that kind of wealth.
I had a good education and was able to get a good job, and so I had an income, and it was certainly terrific to be able to do all the things that we could do with that, but we didn't really have any asset base.
The McMurtrys attended Rice when tuition there was still free, and then came to Silicon Valley 50 years ago. Bert went to graduate school at Stanford and later co-founded a venture capital firm. He says initially the main exit strategy was that he and his partner lost all their money.
Really, it took about 8 years before it began to build at all, and then began to build very dramatically.
So Bert and Dee Dee had some decisions to make. What to do with their newfound wealth.
We decided that who we were and who our children were and how we wanted things to evolve was more like the way we had grown up than like the way we could live if we chose to live in a different way.
The pair now live in a corner apartment here at Classic Residence by Hyatt, an upscale senior living community in Palo Alto.
A lot of the artwork you see is by familiar artists, some by not.
You won't find the McMurtrys flying to appointments in private helicopters or living in an opulent mansion, but they have splurged on a few luxuries, including an extensive art collection.
This is some of the earlier art that we were collecting when in the 70s. In particular, we were interested in abstract art, as were most people.
Bert walks from the spacious, well-lit living wing into the carpeted bedroom wing, past a spare master suite that doubles as a wine cellar.
As you can see, it's a huge place.
One of the toughest questions for the McMurtrys was how much money to give to their children. They were torn between the impulse to provide for one's offspring and the desire not to spoil them.
No one intends to ruin their future family by showering wealth upon them. Now, the amount that we've chosen to leave to them or give to them during our lifetimes and then leave to them is quite large by any standards that we would have been used to before. It's not large by standards that we're now used to. And it is potentially enough money that it could be highly distracting to them and to their children and to their grandchildren.
McMurtry says he hopes the younger generations will keep up the tradition of philanthropy that he and Dee Dee have established. They give to causes including the arts, substance abuse programs, and microfinance in the developing world.
If you ask what kinds of things really interest us greatly, almost anything that enhances economic mobility for people who have nothing or very little to move at whatever pace they can through the economic scenario, and hopefully some of them acquire great wealth and then figure out what to do with it.
McMurtry says choosing which causes to support wasn't easy. The philanthropic possibilities are virtually infinite.
Having an asset base appear in your life and grow produces a set of problems which are really non-trivial. Now, it's just delightful to have these problems, but they're really quite interesting.
Of course, most of us don't have to grapple with how to distribute our millions, but McMurtry says that shouldn't stop us from giving.
We need to encourage people to try to find their passion in individuals and organizations that are doing things that are of high value to them personally, that they value personally, and that incidentally are also contributing very much to the society, and then get involved.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Classic Residence by Hyatt in Palo Alto. Today's event is sponsored by the Humanities Center at Stanford. I'm John Perry. Along with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Rob Reich. He's a professor of political science at Stanford University. He's author of the forthcoming book, Philosophy and Philanthropy. Rob, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Rob, how did a political thought professor, political science professor, get interested in the subject of philanthropy?
I was reading the newspaper a couple of years ago and noticed that in the local section there were a lot of stories that said something about how local citizens here in Palo Alto and elsewhere were giving money away charitably to the public school system. And I thought this was a wonderful example of civic-minded philanthropy. On the other hand, I also thought to myself, people in Palo Alto can give a lot more money away to the Palo Alto schools than the parents in Oakland. So isn't there going to be some inequality that's generated as a result of this philanthropy? And so I decided to look into philanthropy more generally as a result.
So now that you've looked into it, what do you think? You think it's okay for the people in Palo Alto to give money to the Palo Alto schools, to the band and the football team and the debate team, and so that they can offer a fourth year of Latin or whatever, and get a tax break for that? Or you think that's dubious?
I have my concerns, I should admit, because I wonder first about the tax break. The tax break means that when a person gives money away to the Palo Alto school system, the federal government is reducing their tax burden, and essentially the entire U.S. citizenry is subsidizing, to some extent, their charitable gift, which is to say that the U.S. government is compounding the inequality of funding between school districts that already exists.
Well, let me stop you for a second. Okay, we're going to dig into this issue about what the government should do in a bit, but I want to think about it from the individual perspective. I'm thinking about me as an individual. I'm not wealthy, but I have some money to give. Why shouldn't I, whether or not there's a tax break, why shouldn't I focus my giving on the schools in Los Altos rather than the schools in Oakland? My son goes to Los Altos. I care about the children of Los Altos in a special way because they're connected to me. You know, why shouldn't I, as an individual?
From the state's perspective, maybe you should simply have the liberty to give your money away as you fit. You want to burn it? That's not the state's business. You want to consume it? That's fine, too. You want to give it to Los Altos or Oakland or Palo Alto? Also not the state's business. The tax break means something new. Maybe we'll get to that later.
Yeah, we will. We will get to that. But I'm thinking about, as an individual, deciding what to give, what to keep. I love these people. I love them in a special way.
Right.
I care about the world, but I love my local community.
You mentioned before about having to balance the desirability to help those near and dear with those who are further away from us, strangers to us. Warren Buffett has a nice line that I read somewhere. Perhaps it's not original to him, but he said something that when he thinks about giving his money away to his children versus to other causes, he wants to give his kids enough that they can do something, but not so much that they can do nothing.
Yeah, well, that's a good. But still, I'm not sure. Okay, I'm still thinking about the dynamic of, I'm not just giving it to my children. I'm giving it to the local public schools, which are very well off.
Let me make this concrete. How should I think about this? I'm not terribly rich, but maybe I have, you know, $500. And if I give that to a particular school district, like the Palo Alto School District, and they've got a pretty good orchestra, but they could buy a tuba, then they'd be a better orchestra. It'd make a real difference. If I were to spread that over all the poor school districts in California, it would come out probably to about a dime a piece. They couldn't even buy a bottle of tuba polish. So why isn't it better to make an impact in one place than to spread it out so that it really doesn't make any difference?
I think that's the wrong way to think about it, John. I'd think about it in the following way: giving $500 to the Los Altos School District for some tubas versus giving $500 to some essential books that's going to help a kid learn to read in Oakland. And if you could have the same confidence that your gift to Oakland would do that much more good for economic mobility, say, and as compared to tuba playing, you might have a reason to give to Oakland instead of Los Altos.
But if I give to Palo Alto, the Palo Alto School District has some possibility of demonstrating how good a school could be. And in the long run, that might have more of an effect than just leveling things ever so slightly.
I'm going to give you time to sort of think about that so you can really knock it down. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk coming to you from the Classic Residence by Hyatt in Palo Alto, California, in partnership with the Stanford Humanities Center. We're talking about the morality of giving and keeping with our guest, Rob Riche.
We've been looking at issues surrounding giving and keeping from the perspective of individuals and what they should think about or might think about. But in our next segment, we'll take more of a public policy viewpoint. Should the government favor some forms of giving over others? Or should all decisions about where to give be left to the free choice of the individual?
Deciding where to give, plus questions and comments from our live radio audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness, and I guess all those things you always pine for. Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell, baby.
Well, if you want to give your love away in California, you can do that in just about any way you want, to whomever you want, under whatever circumstances you want, but you can't take a tax break for it. Suppose you have more than love to give. Should there be restrictions on who gets a tax break for giving and who doesn't? Who you can give it to and why? Should the government get involved in who you give your money to? Should it favor donating to poor institutions instead of wealthy institutions? Or should the government just keep its nose out of it? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And this is Philosophy Talk. Our subject, the morality of giving and keeping. Today's program is being recorded in front of a live audience at the Classic Residence by Hyatt. Now, we're eager to hear from our audience. You can join us, folks. You can join this conversation. Just raise your hands, and either Devin or Zoe will come by with a mic, and we'll try and get you in on this program.
Our guest is Professor Rob Reich from the Political Science Department at Stanford University.
So, Rob, in a democracy, we said that government has some obligations to ameliorate social and economic inequities. So, doesn't it just follow that the government should incentivize giving that addresses such inequities, and maybe should even discourage, disincentivize giving that perpetuates such inequities?
Let me make that a little more concrete. In other words, should the government really give you a break for giving to Stanford, or should it just give you a break when you give to Habitat for Humanity?
And maybe punish you or some way.
Yeah. And your position on this won't affect your future at Stanford in any way.
So that's pretty much it. What do you think, Rob?
There's two questions. Should the state give you, is the government give you an incentive to give money away? Should it subsidize your liberty to do what you want with your money? Or should it just have a hands-off approach? You want to give it away to a puppet theater, baldness research, Stanford University, Oxford, Oxfam International, whatever. That's
Oxford,
your business.
Oxford. Boy, yeah. There's surely some limits.
Okay. Surely some limits. That's okay. Right. So separate the questions between incentivizing, subsidizing your liberty, and then just having the liberty to do with it what you want. Mm-hmm. When we incentivize people to give money away, when we give them a tax break for giving, if we think that the purpose of charity is to help those who are needy, go back to the classic definitions of charity, almsgiving, helping others in need, then it might be worth making the case that we have to provide incentives only for those donations that go to institutions or organizations that serve the needy and poor, and not to others. You keep the liberty to give the money away wherever you want, but you don't get a tax break unless you give it to an organization which serves the needy.
So you say you might. What do you think? Do you think that the government should only incentivize giving that serves the needy or addresses inequities?
If the government thinks the charity's purpose is to do almsgiving in a way that the government complements what the government does, then I think the tax break has to be harnessed or, you know, connected to that purpose. Or you can reconceptualize charity and think the charity's purpose is, oh, almsgiving's fine, but so is all kinds of other artistic, cultural things,
right,
as well.
There are many public goods. Art museums are public goods. Universities are public goods. And why not think that anything that promotes the public good should be incentivized and let people choose which public goods they want to promote?
Let me follow up on it. I mean, it seems to me that there's two conceptions underlying your picture that one could question. One is the idea that, you know, it's kind of the government's money, and by not taking it all, they're incentivizing you, as opposed to it's not the government's money until they take it, and if they have a policy that they only take a percentage of your income after deductions, then I don't know if that's really incentivizing. Maybe it is. But then charity. I mean, think of tithing. For centuries, people in the Christian world, at least, thought they should tithe, and a lot of people still do that, 10%. Now, that 10% just didn't go to the alms and the poor. It went to to build the Notre Dame Cathedral and to do all sorts of things that have had a lasting influence on our culture. So we don't need to redefine it to say that part of charity or part of tithing or part of, you know, helping build a better society through individual contributions rather than rooting it through taxes It isn't just helping the poor. That's good. But it's also building noble buildings, establishing noble universities, helping preserve great art. Why hasn't that always been a part of it?
Let me put it this way. If you were living in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina roared through, and then you thought that the government failed in its responsibilities to keep you safe and to provide you safe passage out of New Orleans, and you thought that the government ought to do a better job. When we give tax breaks to people who give money away to things like cultural institutions, can't the person in New Orleans complain that they would have received in principle some fractional benefit of a tax dollar that was given away to you to reduce your tax burden for an art institution?
Well, wait a minute, though. That's assuming – go back to the thing we said people give for lots of reasons. Look at the individual motivations. I mean, individual motivations are various. People sometimes want to make a statement. They want to advance a particular cause that they care about. They want to leave a legacy. They want their name on. People give for all kinds of reasons. If the government take notes of the various reasons that people give, then I don't think your argument's right.
I think everyone's eccentric preferences might have some value if we project them into the public sphere. So, Ken, your eccentric preferences are worthy. John, yours too. Maybe mine too. We have different ideas about what to do. But just protect people's liberty to do that. We don't need to provide you a tax break, and a differential one for that matter. Why should you get a bigger tax break than me if our preferences are equally worthy?
Right. I get your point. We've got some questions from our live audience here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk now.
My name is Janice Anderson. I'm a resident here. And in my opinion, after you've paid your taxes, the money that you still have is yours to do exactly with whatever you would like to do. And if the government got into designating where you should spend your charity money, I think there'd be a revolution. I think that is absolutely wrong. We should give it all away to wherever we want to. And we should also remember, money is like manure. I'm a gardener. It is no good unless you spread it around. Therefore, I believe that some of it, your charity money, should go to the poor, and other money should go to universities, art museums, and symphony orchestras, and all the things that contribute to the quality of life in this great country of ours. Thank you.
Well, let me press you on that in a way. So I could see your argument that the government should incentivize giving that does a certain kind of good, addresses inequities and that. But should it really disincentivize giving that doesn't do that? Should it somehow
the question,
be hostile to that kind of giving?
Well, if by hostile you mean simply protect people's liberty, I think that's a strange way of putting it. If you have the liberty to do what the questioner asked, the government taxes you, and after that you're free to do whatever you want, absolutely. But that we already have a system where the government is involved in distinguishing between worthier and less worthier forms of giving. So if you give money to a soup kitchen, you can claim a tax deduction for that charitable gift. If you give money to a poor person on the street, a handout right to that person, you can't deduct that on your income tax. State is telling you, you have a greater incentive to give to an organization. It's already involved in your giving. To be hostile to the giving would be to say, you have the liberty to give money away. We're going to stop you from doing that.
Right.
Say, inheritance taxes. We're going to limit your ability to transmit money. We're going to tax some of that.
Right, exactly. I mean, well, that would be. I think that is a way of saying, you know what? You're not at liberty to give this money. We used to have inheritance taxes. And there is this I believe that some of the founders of our country believe that inherited wealth was a great evil.
Well, I think the whole issue of the legitimacy of inheritance, that's a pretty big issue. But just get back to this idea of should the government, I'm kind of becoming convinced of the premise of your argument. The government is already involved because
it
irritates me that I can't take off a lot of stuff. But wouldn't it be better to just get them completely uninvolved, to just say, well, everybody, they figure out their gross adjusted, I don't know, income. Mine is very gross. It's so small. And then you take 10% and you say, okay, in our opinion, that's yours to do good works with. If you don't, you're a schmuck, but it's none of our business.
Sure. I don't
think it's like the government's money and then it's giving it back when it's just deciding not to take all of it.
If the government were to say to every individual what your proposal is, John, it would be a radical change in the policy we have now. You'd be saying every single taxpayer gets some sort of tax credit or a rebate in their taxes, what they would otherwise owe, and you can now give this away as you wish. But that's not the way the system currently works, in which people with very different means get different sorts of incentives, different amounts of money that's reduced from their tax burden. And let me remind you, 70% of Americans don't itemize on their taxes, which is to say they can't claim any deductions, even though they give, as an absolute percentage of their income, as much or more than the wealthiest Americans.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the morality of giving and keeping with Rob Riche from Stanford University, and we've got questions from our live audience in the back of the room there.
My name is Marion Lewenstein. Going back to your reference to giving money to schools, something that concerns me, if the government is giving you a tax break for donating to a school cause, perhaps the government at the same time is then giving less money to educational purposes, which I think is part of what government should do, is provide for education.
But is that really a problem? I mean, if
yes, yes, it is.
No, I mean, the government should be doing a lot more for education. But is there lack of money for education because of the tax differential from people who are giving to education? Or is it because of things like war? And defense and
perhaps,
and government graft and tax loopholes.
Let's let Rob have the floor here.
Well, why when I'm on a roll?
Bill Gates has created an amazing foundation which does an unbelievable amount of good work, and one of the chief priorities his foundation has said has been school reform in the United States. The U.S. Department of Education has said explicitly that Bill Gates is now taking care of small school reform in the U.S. The government doesn't need to do that anymore. And I think that gets to exactly what the questioner is interested in. Private philanthropy can sometimes crowd out or push away what it is collective responsibility through the state.
But if the government recognizes that people don't have the collective will through endorsing a taxation system that does this stuff adequately, then it can say, well, look, you know what? We're going to incentivize those who do have the will to do it. Is that a bad thing?
Could be. Not always. You might take a long-run horizon here and think that the incentives to allow private charity to replace what government would ordinarily do leads to a long-run trajectory of outsourcing all public services.
I understand that. I understand the worry. We've got more questions from our live audience right here.
I'm Judy Rosner, and my question is really one more of semantics. It's my understanding that philanthropy is more ethics and morality and not philosophy. I'm wondering why you can put it under philosophy.
Well, ethics and morality are branches of philosophy. I mean, philosophy thinks not about just what is, but what ought to be and how we ought to behave and how we ought to believe. So these are actually deeply philosophical issues. We claim this as our turf.
Is that the way you're looking at it,
sure,
Rob?
Sure, sounds good.
Yeah.
But philosophy looks at basic concepts, and there are basic concepts and presuppositions involved in the practice of philanthropy like anything else. For example, one where we seem to disagree is the concept of taxation. I think of taxation as you've got some money, and for a good reason or not so good reason, the government takes some of it. And if they decide not to take some of it, that's not the same as giving it back. But I want to press you on something you said before. When Gates gave the money, or Bill Gates Foundation gave the money, and the government said, oh, since he's given the money, we don't need to do anything, that wasn't Bill Gates pushing them out. That's totally the wrong analogy. It was a government, I suppose the Bush administration, coming up with a feeble excuse for not doing something that they should have been doing. And it seems to me to really take the eye off the ball to suppose that the problem with public funding of education is that too much money is seeping out through the deductions from people who are giving money on their own to education.
But John, you're missing the political dynamics at play here. Take another example. In Woodside, California, right behind where we're taping this, live some of the wealthiest tycoons, captains of Silicon Valley. They have a school foundation there, the Woodside School Foundation, that raises almost as much money on a per pupil basis privately as the state gives the elementary school. The chair of the school foundation said at one point, well, we wouldn't have to raise all this money privately if the state would just step up and do its duty. And of course, one thing you might say to the person is, you're a citizen. Why don't you troop off to Sacramento? You're probably one of the savvier, more politically influential people in the state. The Woodside citizens collectively might be. Go make that argument in Sacramento and see what happens.
I don't follow you. I mean, the citizens of California collectively have decided, through various things, to underfund the schools. I mean, our schools are terribly, terribly funded. Parents in various communities, Woodside, Los Altos, where I live, have these education foundations. The Los Altos Education Foundation raises millions of dollars a year that are focused on the Los Altos schools. I mean, they're compensating for our collective failure to fund the schools. I mean, they're locally forming a local collective to ameliorate a situation. You seem to object to that in some way.
They're acting in their capacity as private citizens locally and reducing the incentive for them to act in their capacity as statewide citizens in Sacramento. We all have limited amounts of time. If I can extract out of my local school district through private contributions the school system that I want, why bother going to Sacramento?
Yeah. Let's get one question from our audience over here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, my name's Ben. You've been talking about the tax deductions that you can take for philanthropic giving and the possibility of the government deciding that giving to Stanford is not as tax deductible as giving to Habitat for Humanity. Isn't there a potential danger if the government starts saying this is worthy, this is unworthy, this is worthy, that you could start to see a strong political influence on how money is given in this country that is being shaped by the government's political agenda and not necessarily by the people themselves?
What do you think about that, Rob, briefly?
I absolutely agree with the questioner. The issue, though, is that the government is already in that business. We already have the government deciding what organizations count as 501c3 nonprofits and which don't. You can't give money away to a for-profit institution, even though it might cohere with your values, and take a tax deduction. So you're absolutely right that this is a real-world concern. I would be as concerned about it as you suggested. However, we're already in that business. And so there's no reason to think we can't begin to make some slightly more finer-grained distinctions rather than just lumping everything together in a uniform category called 501c3.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the morality of giving and keeping with Rob Reich from Stanford University. Today's program is made possible in part with support from the Stanford Humanities Center. We're in front of a live radio audience at the Classic Residence by Hyatt in Palo Alto, California.
We've been talking about issues of public policy and about the moral difference and political significance of donating to various kinds of institutions. In our next segment, we'll adopt a more practical perspective and ask about giving more effectively. Unless we decide to just keep arguing about the same stuff we're already arguing about. How can we make sure that what we do give does the most possible good?
Effective giving, plus more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Chesterfield or an ottoman.
And if I had $1 million, I'd buy your love.
So, if you had $1 million, that used to be real money, what would you do with it? I mean, I give a certain amount of money, and actually the money I give to schools goes through my Rotary Club, mostly to the schools in East Palo Alto. I feel really good about it, and even better about the time when we go over and build a bookshelf or something. What is the most successful piece of giving you've done? You all look about my age. You've probably had a few opportunities to give in your life. What's worked out the best? What did you feel best about? What did you feel did the most good? Or what did you think was really a waste of money and time? I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm Ken Taylor, as Don just said. Our guest is Rob Reich from Stanford University. Our topic for this segment is effective giving. I mean, I know you have some thoughts about how you can make your giving make a difference, be most impactful. Share a little bit of that with us.
If you have a bunch of money and you want to give it away, and what you want to see is impact from your charitable dollars, then there are, actually through internet developments, a lot of resources available now for you to see just how effective organizations are in using your charitable dollars. So, for example, there's an outfit called Charity Navigator. You can find that on the web. It rates organizations based on their efficiency in using charitable dollars. There's an interesting organization called DonorsChoose.org in which you can see a list of teacher projects in public schools that you can fund yourself. Similarly with Kiva now, where you can fund microfinance across the world. So you can be personally involved in your giving.
Yeah, so you can kind of monitor the impact of your giving. We've got lots of questions from our live audience over on this side of the room.
I'm Barbara Burnett, Stanford 38. No economics classes, but I'm very curious to know, the Arilagas have given so much to Stanford, and I am just curious to know what the results would have been if they had been taxed on all the money that they gave to Stanford.
Well, so suppose some of those gifts had been taxed away. Are you wondering whether that would be morally better, socially better, if that money had been taxed away?
They've obviously given millions and millions. They're probably in a high tax bracket, so that means hundreds and hundreds of thousands would have gone to the state and federal government. Those things wouldn't have been reserved for education. Probably the presence of the Arilagas money wouldn't have changed the relative neglect of education at both the California and state levels. So I would say, if you hold everything else constant, except that the Arilagas don't do anything for Stanford, or that they do less for Stanford because the money they spend is taxed.
Can I try and answer
nothing,
that?
Nothing much changes except that the admittedly absolutely luxurious athletic facilities we have aren't quite as good.
Rob, let me put to you a more abstract question. So, okay, the government could not give these tax incentives. Right. They could instead tax.
Yep.
Of course, more money gets given away through the incentives than they would recover through taxing. I mean, what's the social calculus there?
An economist's question here that's really important is what role the tax incentive plays in shaking off more charitable dollars than would otherwise be given away anyway. Do people give more money away because of the tax break than they would get otherwise? Or is the tax break kind of like a pat in the back for doing what you would do anyway? The answer to that question is a complicated one, and I don't think the jury's in, so to speak, but it's not obvious. Or it's not a knockdown case that the tax incentive shakes out a lot more money than would be given anyway. Because people give money away because people ask them to, because it's important for them to, because it's a virtue to do so, because it brings them a really good feeling. The tax incentive is secondary, tertiary, way down the list in terms of motivations.
At the risk of being over on your side of the court for a minute.
Oh, don't do that.
That's probably true, except if you realize that institutions like Stanford or even institutions like my little college in Nebraska, Doane College, devote a lot of money to hiring really good salesmen to go out there and use the tax structure as a wedge to separate people from their money. And, it's hard to believe that doesn't have an effect.
He said it's tertiary. He didn't say it was non-effect. But, we've got more questions from our live radio audience here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yes. I think what you're saying is very laudable, and I appreciate it. And I'm also, we were in the nonprofit world. But I'm wondering, what would you do with all that money that is being expended on buying the presidency, which it runs into, tell me how many billions of dollars are being expended? And while they're using it on our internet, on our network, which belongs to all of us, what would you do with all that money that's been collected? And I don't quite know how much it is, but it's a lot.
It certainly is, especially this time around, and especially the Democrats, surprisingly. But, Rob, I think that's more of a question for you.
Here's a good illustration of where sometimes the state really ought to intervene, ought to constrain your liberty to give money away. And in the political process is, I think, one of the best cases for that. Should we allow wealthy people the ability to give unlimited amounts of money away to influence political outcomes? Even if we say it's your money, you should be able to do with it what you want. I think the answer to that is, in a democracy, you shouldn't be able to amplify your political significance, your political influence, simply because you have a fat wallet. There's a problem with that.
Yeah, but that's the way it looked 12 months ago, right? Well, we have the Supreme Court saying that you can't limit the spending because it limits freedom of speech. But now Obama's raised more money than anybody else, and he's done it without a lot of rich. I'm sure there's a lot of rich people involved, but mostly $100, $200 contributions. Most of his contributors aren't anywhere near their limit.
But
is that amount of money being spent just as bad a thing if it comes from a lot of small contributors?
The issue to me seems whether or not we as citizens are equally situated to have political influence. And if all the money is coming in $200 increments from a lot of people, that seems to say something in favor of Obama's capacity to mobilize people to get involved rather than have them sit back on the sidelines and be indifferent.
Okay, so one way that would solve this is public financing of elections, which I think that would be a wise thing. But, you know, the citizens collectively, I mean, Americans are funny people. We don't like taxation. Even people who benefit and net benefit from taxation somehow think they're overtaxed. They want government services, they want wealth to influence politics, but they don't want to have this tax structure that says, well, these are public goods. I mean, we're really funny about this.
But we have public financing. What we would have to have is required public
financing.
Right,
exactly, yeah. So, I mean, if I'm the government planner and I'm looking at Americans not wanting to be taxed, and I'm looking at all these public goods that need to be pursued, I think, well, I'll use the tax code creatively.
But at least contributions to political candidates are not deductible.
Correct.
This
is something I try to address in what I'm writing. There's three fundamental questions. You've got some money as an individual. The state has three choices before it about how it should treat you and your money. It can respect your liberty to do with it what you want, non-interference, non-intervention. It can limit your liberty to do with it what you want, estate taxation, campaign finance restrictions, or it can subsidize you to act on your liberty to give money away, give you a tax break. We need to have a political theory. We need collectively to determine when the state takes which approach.
And you have some wisdom. You're writing a book about this. You have some wisdom about this? Tell me, to help us think about this, and then help us think about how we as individuals fit into a just system of this sort.
Very, very quickly, the default position seems to me, we ought to protect the liberty of people to give money away. Non-interference, non-intervention. You've got money, it'd be wrong for the state to step in and do something about that, to say otherwise. There are some special cases where it seems it's appropriate to limit your ability to give money away. Campaign finance, I think, is one of the easiest examples to point to. I think many people think that the case is obvious to make about when the state should subsidize your liberty to give money away. I happen to think the case for that is less obvious.
Right, right. What about inheritance taxes in your way of thinking? Because that's a way of harnessing your money to the public good rather than the private good.
Correct. And not only that, inheritance taxes might be a good reason for people to give more money away charitably, because right. If they see themselves at the threat at death of being taxed significantly by the state, they'd rather give a lot of money away during their lifetimes to organizations that can do something with it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the morality of giving and keeping with our guest, Rob Reich from Stanford University. We've got a questioner on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
My question is, shouldn't certain kinds of giving be separated from others? There's a lot of giving that's done, not really altruistically, but what people can buy. I'm talking about political giving, corporations, buying votes, things of that kind. I think that's a separate category. And it isn't what I call giving for the public good or giving for philanthropic reasons. It's buying something.
When charity becomes consumerism, when instead of giving something away that creates a public good, we're creating a private consumption, I get to buy someone's vote, I get to buy a corporation's behavior, then the case for giving a tax subsidy for that giving seems even shakier.
Although your ideas are based on a lot of research and thinking over years, and mine are based on about 10 minutes of talking to you, I still kind of like mine. Think about the way it works with children. I mean, you got three kids, you get a certain deduction. You know, you just don't pay taxes on that amount. Now, nobody checks up to actually spend that on your kids. They're just saying, gosh, if you're a parent, you ought to be spending this on your kids, and we shouldn't be taking it away from you. I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be better just to have a kind of a tithe thing. Say, well, you know, historically, you should give 10% of your wealth to the poor and good public causes, and so we're not going to tax you on 10% of your wealth, and then just leave it up to the people, and don't have all of these forms to fill out and count the number of worn-out sweaters you give to Goodwill and stuff like that.
Everyone gets a chance to tithe equally, and the paperwork goes down.
Paperwork goes down, absolutely.
So if I thought I mean, I'm going to go back to this libertarian thought, mm-hmm. right? So maybe the government should just, you say it is in the business of discriminating. Maybe it, why shouldn't it just say hands off? Yeah. People, you know, people, like I said, people give for lots of different reasons. I mean, some people, some giving, let's be frank, is very kind of ego-driven. You want to you want to leave a monument to yourself, right? Some of it is in homage to your ancestors. You know, many people endow chairs at universities in the name of their beloved grandparent who was an expert in such and such, and they want to pay some homage to that ancestor, right? I see nothing wrong with that. If you just left it to the good graces of people to give where they saw fit, and some people are deeply altruistic, right? What would be wrong with that? Just say, hands off, give what you choose, do with your life as you will, give to your children as you will, give to your causes as you will. Is there anything morally
that
problematic?
Seems to me the default position, that where the government protects your liberty to give money away, and if you can give it to wherever you want based on your heart's content, then it's just on your own conscience about how to decide how to allocate those funds. But there seems that would be a radical revolution in how we treat charitable giving today.
It would, but I'm wondering, I know it would be a radical revolution, but I'm wondering, is there anything sort of morally problematic about that? I mean, if that's the default position, why aren't we, is there some good moral reason why we are not in that default position?
The explanation about how it is we got the policies today would take us a long time to describe.
No, I'm not talking about how we got the policies, right? But from a moral perspective, how to evaluate those policies relative to that default position.
I think the default position has a lot to be said for it morally, and we've got to have some really powerful reasons to say to a donor, we want to subsidize you to act on your liberty to give money away. And those powerful reasons, I think, in the cases of giving, are either not well appreciated or are non-existent.
Well, you know, I do think the history is a little bit interesting because a lot of the tax law was figured out during a time when the incremental tax rates were extremely high, up above 90%. And, you know, when the last dollar is being taxed at 90%, and then you say to the person who wants to use that money for Stanford or something, you basically, you know, you have to give Stanford $10 for every dollar you actually get through or something like that. That's much different. Now we have relatively, compared to then, low incremental tax rates. And compared, if we went to something like people call the flat tax or the fair tax, then I would think the idea of there being any kind of recognition in the taxes for giving would pretty much be beside the point.
So why don't you make one last comment? This will be your last comment.
Yeah, so let me introduce one more thing because it's on this very topic. If you happen to think that being charitable, giving money away for some other public cause, is itself a virtue, that doing so is part of living a good life, then you might have another reason still to be worried about the tax incentive. Because then you have to worry, is my motive to give this money away, this financial one, which is sort of polluting the personal virtue of giving, whereas if the state is wholly uninvolved, then if you're charitable, you can build your personal virtue or demonstrate your personal virtue without the worry that of this polluting financial incentive that the state is dangling in front of you.
Well, on that note, I'm gonna thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Rob Reich, professor of political science at Stanford University, author of the forthcoming book Philosophy and Philanthropy.
We also want to thank our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a big round of applause.
So, John, you said Rob's ideas were based in years of research and yours were 10 minutes of thinking. So what did you learn today?
in 10 minutes of thinking, I can come up with some really good ideas. No, I thought the most interesting comment was from the young lady in front who asked, what does philosophy have to do with philanthropy? And what I learned is what I always learn. You can pick up any topic that seems pretty remote from philosophy. It'll be based on certain concepts, certain ways of thinking, and when you dig into them, there'll be alternatives. There'll be hard to see the reasons why we think of it this way instead of that way, and it'll be fun to talk about, at least for people like you and I.
Yeah, you know, I actually think, I mean, Rob is writing this book about this that's part philosophy, part political theory, because he's a political theorist, and it doesn't seem to be a topic that has gotten a huge, huge amount of thinking, but it seems to me fraught with all kinds of issues about equality and the nature of government and the role of democracy. So, I mean, I actually think it's really a cool topic, and I'm glad we could start thinking about it, you know. But, you know, as always, this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Susan Spiller, David Redfield, and the staff of Classic Residence by Hyatt Palo Alto, and to Susan Sebbard and John Bender. Also thanks to Dan Brandon, Zoe Carnelli, Corey Goldman, and Bert McMurtry.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research, and Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Stanford Humanities Center, various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and from Powell City of Books. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Thank you.